Welcome to The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, the news director here at WCAI, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Brennan. She's the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. And joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner and Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times. Let's start with the big story, Anne Brennan. The immigrant children, the detained children. But let's, before we go all through all the happenings of the week, let's start with just some of the basic facts here. So no decisions have been made yet about these children coming to Cape Cod and being located on Joint Base Cape Cod. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And there aren't any children here yet, right?
Right. There are no children here yet. We have been getting calls and other things of people saying there's children on the base. We've seen the children. We even had to run a story to say there are no unaccompanied immigrants that have been taken or put on this base. The children that are there are the dependents of the 200 military families who live on the base. Mm-hmm. They're with the Coast Guard, National Guard. There's active duty Air Force. Those are the children that are out there, according to the base officials.
So these are children who are coming over the border of Mexico from other countries. Where are they coming from? Give us the background.
Generally, they're coming from mainly from Central America. They're showing up on the Mexican border in California and Texas, principally, I think, Arizona as well, and New Mexico. And there are children coming who are not with any parents. Mm-hmm. And some youngish, very young ones are, some are coming with parents, but there are children as young as 3 years old who show up at the border unaccompanied. And because of federal law, we take them in, and then there's a process that has to be gone through involving courts and deciding whether the children should be reunited with family that's already in the United States, whether they should gain asylum for safety reasons. They're saying about 5% of these children are getting asylum, and then which ones are going back to where they came from.
So they need a place to keep them until they can have the appropriate hearings?
Right. And there, from what I understand from news reports from NPR and others, is that there are not enough legal people, judges and lawyers and other resources to make this a quick process. We're hearing that when children come in and they've been placed at least three bases that we know of, mm-hmm. It's taking about 35 days to process these children and either return them to their families, reunite them with their families if they're living in the United States and their families are living in the United States.
I see.
And or send them back to Central America, but they can't be returned until they go through this legal process, which could take much longer.
And George Brennan, one of the reporters at the Cape Cod Times, did a story looking at some of those other military installations around the country that already are housing detained children. And what are some of their experiences?
Well, he talked to editors of a paper in Ventura County, California, where a naval base there is hosting some of these children, as well as the editor of a paper near Fort Sill in Oklahoma. And what those editors are saying is that no one sees these children. Oh. They come in, they stay on base. Their education is, and other health and other care is provided on the base. There was the exception in California where two of the children had to be taken to a local hospital because they had pneumonia. But that's really the only time that they're seeing these children. The editor at the Oklahoma paper said one of the things they are seeing on the positive side is that there apparently are federal contractors who are helping care for these children, and they are actually adding to the local economy by staying in hotels, eating in restaurants, and shopping in local shops. But that's what we're hearing. There is no the kids, they are either reunited with their families who are living here in mm-hmm. America, or they stay on the base.
I see. And so what happened here in Massachusetts? Governor Deval Patrick, I think it was last week,
right,
said Well, hey, we might be able to house some of these detained children.
President Obama has asked the governors of all the states if they would be willing to host some of these children in a facility that's secure and appropriate for care, a place where children could live for a short period of time, you know, room to play and, you know, appropriate sleeping conditions, mm-hmm. that type of thing. And Governor Patrick offered Westover Air Base in the western part of the state, as well as Camp Edwards on Cape Cod, which, as many of your listeners probably recall, hosted refugees from the Katrina hurricane, Katrina,
oh, sure.
from New Orleans. There was the whole town was underwater and homes were wiped out. People really were displaced. And at this point, earlier this week, the Bourne selectmen voted unanimously to write a letter to Governor Patrick saying, we don't want them. We do not support this. And there's been protests.
Yeah, that's kind of, I think, where it ended up on a lot of people's radar screen when they heard about this protest this past Sunday at the Rotary outside of Joint Base Cape Cod, with some folks holding signs and saying to the governor basically, hey, we don't want these children here. And I think some of those signs were upsetting to some others, just judging from what the response was on the editorial page of the newspaper.
Right. Well, they were signs that, you know, no way, Jose, coming soon to your school, TB and scabies. I mean, there were signs that people felt were more inflammatory than necessary. Our reporter, Ethan Genter, was out there when they were protesting. It was about 20 people. And of the motorists who responded to the protesters, those responding were overwhelmingly supporting those protesters. But the next day,
you mean by driving
by honking thumbs up,
right, okay.
So, but those are just the people who responded. They're not
sure
everybody. But then the next day, Occupy Falmouth had
a rally.
And a lot of people from local churches were there in support of. About 60 people showed up and showed their support for caring for these children who are leaving situations that we're told, you know, is very dangerous, that kids are being forced into the drug trades, that, you know, it's just a really dangerous situation.
Mm. A lot of rhetoric around this,
a lot
of uncertainty. So they're still working out whether they can come up with a plan to house them there. No decisions have been made yet, right?
From what I understand, from the Patrick administration, a fellow was at the Bourne selectman meeting earlier this week. He said the Health and Human Services Department hasn't even started evaluating Camp Edwards or Westover yet. That the offer has been put out there by Governor Patrick. They're waiting for the feds to come in and see if any of these, either of these two places, meet the standards required. Also, there's going to, in order, if there is an agreement that we will house that children will be housed at the base,
yep.
then there has to be a memorandum of understanding signed between state officials and the federal government officials. And David Vieira, Representatives David Vieira and Randy Hunt, along with Congressman William Keating, want the local people to be able to have some say in that memorandum of understanding. I think that's part of what people are upset about on the local official level, is that they're just going to do this. Nobody talked to us about it. We don't know what the implications are of hosting these children. In the past, you know, Bourne School District educates the dependents of military families on the base. They're not always reimbursed by the federal government. And they try to get the state legislature tries to reimburse them every year. So there's issues that they've dealt with in the past, mm-hmm. that they want to make sure that those bases are covered. By having some say about this.
And you mentioned that Bourne selectman meeting, I believe that was Tuesday night, and very raucous meeting from what I can gather, but at least it was an attempt to kind of improve communication and dispel some of what may be untruths about what's happening.
There are so many rumors going around, like you mentioned, the children, and we're hearing all the time the kids are here. And they were trying to, like you say, explain, here's how the system works. You know, they would have to, Health and Human Services would have to come in and evaluate the place. And also that how long the children would be there. They're saying that, you know, a year ago it was taking about 70 days to process these kids through these centers. Now it's taking about 35 days. But the children who then are reunited with family members living in the United States, it can be as long as 3 to 5 years before they get a court date or a court determination of whether they can stay in the country or not. So they were, and also what came out is that more than 700 children, unaccompanied minors, have already been reunited with family members living in Massachusetts. And there are some mayors, like of Lynn and I believe Springfield, who before this even hit our radar of whether kids would be coming here or not, who were saying that the services, it's really hitting us financially, providing for this influx of children. So there's things that need to be worked out
sure.
along the way.
And the Born Selectmen voted unanimously to send a letter to the governor. So they're unanimous.
They
okay. And I heard that there was some reaction from Senate President Therese Murray, who is from Plymouth, to the Born meeting and such.
Right. And she actually represents the town of Born, and
right.
It's in her district. And she said she was appalled by some of the rhetoric, some of the signs at the Sunday protests, that it wasn't that long ago that people were saying the same thing about her ancestors who came from Ireland. You know, Irish need not apply,
sure.
Dirty and diseased, you know. And so she's just trying to tell people, you know, find your humanity. That's her point of view.
I see. So there also was a note in one of the stories today that I read that it does appear at this point, at least to some officials, that the Air Base Cape Cod, Air Station Cape Cod, Joint Base Cape Cod, does appear to be a better site for hosting children than Westover Air Reserve Base.
Right.
And maybe something that might have to do with the fact that they do have experience with the Katrina refugees, as you referred to them back in 2005.
I think the other thing is that, and this is another concern by local officials, is that the base is set up to be an evacuation shelter if there's a major disaster, if we're hit by a hurricane or some other disaster. That's where they plan to shelter people. And there's concerns that if we put the kids there, up to, they're saying, 1,000 kids, is there going to be room if we need that base in a natural disaster? But I think it is more appropriate. It is looked at as being more appropriate than Westover because of that very nature of preparing these shelters.
Okay. Well, we'll continue to cover this story as it evolves. Brian Morris was at that protest at the Rotary earlier this week, and we aired some of the sound and some of the reports from that. And I was at the rally in Falmouth on Monday in support of the children. So clearly there's a big community discussion going on around this issue. But we're going to take a break, and we'll move on. And when we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup. When we discuss the top news stories of the week, I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Brennan. She's the Assistant Managing Editor for News at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, which is based in Chatham. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Thanks for joining us. Let's talk about Skydive Cape Cod and the Chatham Airport. We've spoken about this quite a bit over the past year or so. Give us the background on Skydive Cape Cod at the airport, and then what's the news?
Okay. Earlier this year, the town manager here in Chatham had declined to renew the lease for Skydive Cape Cod, which operated out of the airport since about 2012. The operation was controversial. One of the Skydive company's planes landed in a pond near the airport in May 2012. And while no one was hurt, the neighbors seized on that as indicating safety problems with the operation. And there were also complaints about skydivers screaming as they floated to the earth.
I can attest to that. I screamed when I skydived as well. One time.
It seems like a natural reaction to
it
me.
It does.
I haven't done it, but I don't blame the people who do it.
Right.
And At this point, the town appealed to the Federal Aviation Administration to grant a waiver in order to prohibit skydiving at the airport, which is an activity that is considered an allowed activity at a general aviation airport like Chatham, which has received federal dollars. At the same time, the owner of the skydive company filed a complaint with the FAA, charging that the town had no right to deny the lease. And both of these actions are still pending. And meanwhile, there's no skydiving at Chatham Airport this summer because the lease, of course, was not renewed. And for neighbors of the airport, this is great. They've had a happy summer. They say that it's the quietest summer they've had in years. But the airport itself is hurting because of the banning of skydiving. Tim Howard, who manages the airport under a contract with the town, says his business is down quite a bit. In the past few summers, he's taken on extra help, specifically because of the business that skydive brings in. He had an extra mechanic in his shop and a part-time desk clerk. People who run the restaurant at the airport, called Hangar B, they aren't sure if it's hurt their bottom line, but they say that people ask about skydiving all the time, and they've expressed unhappiness that they can't watch the skydivers while they're eating their meals. Jimmy Mendonca, who's the owner of Skydive, is working off Cape this summer. He's been down in Dallas and New York putting together whatever business he can. And he's not here, he had hired about a dozen or more people over the past couple summers. So they're not here, and so there's definitely been an economic impact. Whether that outweighs the safety and noise issues is something that town officials are going to have to consider as they continue to pursue the issue with the FAA, which I spoke with them, and they had no idea when this issue was going to be resolved. They said that they're looking at it, the complaint. They didn't say anything about the town's request. We hear sort of through the back door that the FAA has sort of looking at this issue at top policy levels because of the concern that if they grant a waiver to the town, it'll set a precedent, and there could be a flurry of requests to ban skydiving at small airports around the country. So that's kind of where we're at right now.
Okay, I'm sure we'll continue to talk about that story. Let's speak about a resident in Harwich who says he thinks he's found some evidence of an ancient Native American meeting house.
Indeed. For much of his life, Don Bates, who lives in Harwich, has walked the Punkhorn, which is a vast conservation area that sits between Harwich and Brewster. And for years, he's heard stories about a Native American meeting house located in the woods there. And he believes now that he's found evidence of its location. And he's collected bricks and other artifacts from a site in the Punkhorn. It's actually, I think, on the Brewster side of Seymour Pond. The site matches the description of the meeting house location that are in historical documents and area history books. The meeting house apparently dates from 1700 or before, and was last used by the Sakwatucket Indians, which was the local Harwich branch of the tribe, the Nauset Indians from this area. Eventually, the area was excavated and used for part of the cranberry industry in the 1800s. But that site where the meeting house was apparently located was near a hill, and apparently it wasn't disturbed as much as other surrounding land. And kind of ironically, Bates said that paths dug out through the Punkhorn by dirt bikers revealed some pieces of glass and other primitive bricks that he found that he believes indicate the location of the meeting house. Now, he's been in touch with local archaeologists and the Cape Cod Museum of Natural History, and is hoping that if this find can be confirmed, that there can be some kind of protection put in place around the location. It's Punkhorn is conservation property, so there's no building that can take place there that can't be disturbed, but he hopes that there can be an extra level of protection and maybe somehow marking this area as the historical site that he believes it is.
Does this resident have any credentials or archaeology experience or anything
I don't. Other than living in the area his entire life and recognizing that the material he found does date from a couple hundred years ago at the very least, if not more. He pointed to the composition of the very primitive brick and the glass, which he thinks dates from a later time, but was part of probably a midden that was in that area that probably dates from the time of the meeting house.
Oh, interesting. Okay, you can follow Tim and the Cape Cod Chronicle Newsroom on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. And Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. And Tim, we always enjoy having you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan. She's the assistant managing editor for news at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. One of the big stories of the week, Ann, across the Commonwealth, and I assume across New England, is the Market Basket story. Talk about a beloved supermarket. If there is a beloved supermarket, it seems to be Market Basket. We can remember when the Market Basket opened up here on the Cape just, what, maybe 2 years ago now. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, the deli counter is like the New York Stock Exchange. I mean, just dozens upon dozens of people. And you walk out of there and it's like, wait, how can my bill be this much considering how much food I have in my cart? And so people really, really like that supermarket. Now that there's been some change in management and leadership at Market Basket, there are protests going on. Tell us about this.
Right. This is... happened at the CEO level. Actually, Mark, just for way of background, Market Basket was started about 100 years ago. And in the 50s, it was sold to two brothers, George and Telemachus Demoulas, who then had children. Arthur S. was the child of George. Arthur T. was the child of Telemachus. George, the father, died in early 70s, leaving Telemachus pretty much in charge of the store. He grew it. And over that time, he started taking more control stock-wise of the company. That led to a lawsuit in the mid-1990s. It was a pretty sensational trial that was going on. And in the end, the judge had ruled that Telemachus had Arthur T. had cheated some of the nieces and nephews out of their shares and ruled that the Arthur S. side of the family would get 50.5% of the shares, leaving the Arthur T. side of the family with 49.5%. However, one of the Arthur S. relatives continued to vote with the Arthur T. side until last year. Arthur S. took control of the company and the board, or their Arthur S. side of the family. And that culminated in June with the firing of Arthur T. as the CEO. Since that time, there's been a lot of objections on the part of the employees and some customers who have appreciated Arthur T's low prices, the model that they have. They offer low prices, and they can do that by certain efficiencies that they have in their business model. He's also beloved by his employees, many of whom have worked for the company for many years, because there's been a family. They say there's been a family atmosphere at the company, as well as profit sharing and other great benefits that most people in the grocery business right now don't enjoy. And so they started protesting the fact that these employees and some customers started protesting the fact that Arthur T. was fired and they want him reinstated. And they stopped deliveries to the stores. So the stores they have very short supplies of produce and meat. And like you say, the deli counter, the refrigerated foods. And in the meantime, the new co-CEOs and Arthur S. are trying to say, look, trust us. We just need time for trust, for you to trust us. Arthur T's not coming back. And so there have been protests at the store in Sagamore that.
Oh, really?
Right. On Wednesday, there was a protest by employees, and there were customers there that said, I'm not shopping there. I'm boycotting until they bring Arthur T back. There's been 37 lawmakers and mayors who are also supporting a boycott of Market Basket.
Well, we used to call it Demoulas
right.
years ago.
Demoulas Market Basket.
Right.
So you know, a lot of people are, you know, I've heard interviews on NPR and other places of labor lawyers and other people looking at these situations, and they're pretty much marveling at how the loyalty, not only on the part of these long-term employees, eight of whom has lost their jobs because of job actions,
but also about people
who shop there.
Shop there. I think that they underestimated that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The reaction's been amazing. I don't think we've seen the size of the protests that they have had up in places like Danvers or at the headquarters in Tewksbury.
Right.
But yes, we have had. And then there is a meeting today.
So I just to backtrack, they have had the protests and rallies. There's about 20 to 25,000 employees of the company.
Oh.
It's $4 billion in revenue. It's not a small company.
No.
They have 71 stores in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine. And they estimated about 5,000 people showed up at the employee rally last weekend. Eight employees, senior employees, lost their job because of that. And today there's another rally going on in Tewksbury, but also at 4 o'clock today in Boston, the board is going to meet again. Arthur T. on Wednesday offered to purchase the company. He says he's made a fair offer for the company, and we'll see what happens. But the problem is only the board that can take action on this to reinstate Arthur T. or to decide to sell the company. The other thing that the employees see is that since Arthur S. took over the board, his side of the family took over the board, they've taken about $250 to $300 million out of the company, paid in dividends to shareholders, which are family members. And that's another thing that some of the employees are saying, as if they keep doing that, and they have been talking about making adjustments to the profit sharing plan that they do have for employees. That's another thing driving employees to support Arthur T.
Okay, and as you said, that board meeting is later today, and there are also supposed to be more protests surrounding the entire issue as we go forward. Sally Rose is on the phone. She's, of course, the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Tom.
Speaking of markets, there's been some controversy in Provincetown regarding the farmers market. I think that's moved around a few times. Where does that stand now? The selectmen are involved in this farmers market issue?
Well, yes, and just to give folks a little history, so the Provincetown farmers market has been pushed and pulled and sort of prodded a bit over the last several years. And this incarnation started about 7 years ago in the Ryder Street parking lot, and that's a small lot across from the town hall. But when neighbors of the lot complained that it was a major inconvenience to have their access blocked every Saturday in season, Selectmen decided to move it to the parking spaces on Ryder Street, and that's alongside the town hall property in the street. So with their trucks parked right behind the booths, for vendors' convenience, it meant that the street then had to be limited to one way only. Well, after about a month or so of dealing with that on busy Saturdays in summer, several residents and businesses complained that it was impeding customers' access and creating a potential hazard for emergency vehicles, they said. So that at the end of last week, the selectmen decided to have the market vendors park their trucks back in the Ryder Street parking lot, but just in a portion of it. And that presumably will leave spaces still available for the nearby residents. And this compromise was welcomed by the market organizer, Andy Pollock. He's the farmer who comes from Dartmouth. So now we'll see how that goes for the local residents and business owners. I'm sure we'll hear about that soon.
Is it a pretty big farmer's market?
It's not.
No.
It's not. It has maybe, I would say, eight or so vendors.
Okay. There's a new houseboat in Provincetown Harbor, and that's not unusual, I would imagine, but this one used to be located on land.
Right, and it's a very cool story. This is, or was, a 16 by 32 foot single-family cottage that once sat on Chatham's North Beach.
Huh.
And it was the longtime summer home of two guys, seasonal Chatham residents, Colin Fuller and Kopi Coppage. And their family shared it as a summer retreat since the early 1990s. The cottage had been reconstructed in 1992 by Chatham builder Bob Stello after the original North Beach cottage was basically buried by the no-name storm. But since 2009, this house has really been on the move, basically, and that's when Mike Winkler, he's a Truro resident and a crane company operator, he was hired to rescue the cottage from the eroding end of the Nauset Beach Spit, where the surf was, we were told, through the windows of the little cottage. Winkler and his crew lifted the house onto a barge and had it towed to Ryder's Cove in North Chatham for the owners. But after several years of trying to find a new home for the house, the owners were basically at their wits' end. So they again contacted Winkler, who had expressed interest in the cottage back in 2009, and they decided to sell it to him for a dollar. So Winkler, Mike Winkler, floated the cottage from Ryder's Cove to Provincetown on a barge that was towed by the Provincetown fishing vessel, the Sea Hunter, and it came up the ocean side of the Cape and around Long Point, and it now sits on a mooring instead of a foundation, and it's out near the breakwater right off the end of McMillan Pier in the harbor, and it's the latest houseboat to be welcomed there. I guess Mike Winkler plans to install solar panels for power, and it's waiting on a 210-gallon water tank to round out the plumbing, and his family plans to use it as a getaway spot.
How nice. Interesting story. That is interesting. Sally, thank you very much. Sally, of course, is the editor of the Provincetown Banner, and she joins us each week here on the News Roundup. Thanks, Sally.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to speak to Jim DeRuda. He is the editorial page editor of the New Bedford Standard Times. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, the news director here at WCAI, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan. She's the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone is Jim DeRuda. He's the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. Welcome to The Point, Jim.
Good morning, Sean. Ann.
Good morning. And so let's talk about the police station in Dartmouth. So town police in Dartmouth have been working out of the Sheriff Tom Hodgson's Mobile Operations Center for the past few months. Why have they not been in their own building?
Well, in March, they had an officer come down with Legionnaire's disease, and when they did a search of the police station, they found it in the heating system. They found the bacterium in the heating hot water system. It's been costing them about $12,000 a month to work out of the trailers and use portable sanitary facilities.
And so where does it stand with that mold now?
It's a pretty old building. It was originally built as the town hall in 1924. It was renovated in, I think, about 2004, early 2000s. And that's when they put a peaked roof on it, but there have always been moisture infiltration issues, and when they put that peaked roof, they had a lot of trouble, too. There's a lot of pipes that are sunk straight into concrete, and there's a lot of corrosion. So there's more mold, there's more corrosion, and all sorts of water-related problems, leaks, heating problems.
Wow. So they talking new police station in Dartmouth?
It looks like the select board is trying to put its ducks in a row. They're making the argument that this facility is in really rough shape. So they've sent out an architect who's going to both price a rehab of this building, which happens to be built in a flood zone and happens to be in the south end of town, which, when it was made the town hall, was the center of the population, but it's not anymore. And the architect will also look at the cost of a new building.
Okay. Another story in the New Bedford Standard Times this week is about the Whaling City Festival. Of course, New Bedford is known as the Whaling City, right?
Yeah.
And the Whaling City Festival probably belongs in New Bedford, but it's moving to a different city.
Yeah, it's been there for 41 years. In 2006, though, they had a great big brawl, 23 people arrested, 3 police officers got minor injuries, so the city said, we'd better close this down a little earlier because it's late at night when the trouble happens. Well, by closing things earlier, a lot of the food vendors, some of the more higher-end vendors, and some of the amusement operators said, we can't make a profit if we're shutting down at 8 o'clock. The city allowed them to stay open till 9 this year, but because of planning, and the mayor has accused them of mismanaging it financially.
Accused who? The organizers?
The organizers of the Whaling City Festival.
Okay.
Of nothing criminal, but just of being sloppy and.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the vendors just said, sorry, not interested. So there's no Whaling City Festival this year. So they went down the street to Fall River and talked to Mayor Will Flanagan over there. And Mayor Flanagan says, you bet you can open up here next year. And they're going to make sure it's alcohol-free. They're going to try and stay open till 11 p.m. It's really an interesting phenomenon that some kinds of festivals are not succeeding in the cities. In Fall River, they have one that's been running for 25 years called Fall River Celebrates America, and they had to shut it down in 2010. The costs were too high, and they just weren't able to keep it going. On the other hand, each of these cities has wildly popular religious festivals. One in New Bedford that starts next week is the Feast of the Blessed Sacrament, and that is like a big party, a four-day-long party with music and Madeiran wine and tons of food and, cultural entertainment, but also old rock bands from back in the day. And then in Fall River, there's no alcohol at all, but they have the Feast of the Holy Ghost, and people, busloads from Canada and all of New England, come to these festivals.
Interesting. So when the Whaling City Festival leaves the Whaling City to go over to Fall River, do you expect that they'll change the name? Any discussion about that?
It looks like they're going to call it the Spindle City Festival.
All right. Okay, on that note, Jim Deruda is the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. He's also a regular here on the News Roundup, and we thank you, Jim. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And with me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan, the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Real Cape Cod story this week, Ann, regarding access to Long Beach. And I guess there's a little pathway that goes from a parking lot between some homes, some million-dollar homes, and that pathway has been used for a long time by folks to get to the beach, but not anymore.
Right, just a slight correction there.
Okay.
The path runs from Long Beach Road, so it's off of Long Beach Road to the beach, and across the street from, it's called Cross Road. The path is called Cross Road, even though it's a grassy path. Across the street on Long Beach Road is a small parking lot, but this is a path that has been used, or as they call it in Barnstable, a way to water. It's been in use since 1911, according to town councilor Frederick Chirigotis. And the homeowner, Anastasia Marty, who lives at 249 Long Beach Road, went to land court to say, I own this property. And a judge ruled that the town had failed in several ways to prove that that Cross Street was property laid out as a public way in accordance with statutory requirements, and ruled in her favor, saying that that is her property, not the town's. So now, instead of a way to water sign, which used to be there, it's posted as private property, no trespassing.
And where in Barnstable are we talking about?
This is in Centerville.
It's in Centerville.
Right. Okay. And the town, which has many ways to water paths, quote-unquote ways to water is what they call them. Chirigotis is saying this is a dangerous precedence that's being set. It could close off paths all over town. So the town is appealing this ruling. It's on appeal. The judge in the case denied a motion to hold off on saying that this is private property until the appeal is settled, but he ruled in late June that I'm not going to stay this judgment pending appeal. So the town, in the meantime, had voted to spend $500,000 in Community Preservation Act money, and may take this piece of property by eminent domain. That's one of the things they're considering, depending on how this goes. But that might be
a deterrent to some homeowners in the future from going forward with the same challenge.
Right. And they're trying to preserve people's access to beach.
Sure.
To the beach. So it's, Massachusetts is different than many, many places. It's really this in Massachusetts and Maine are the only places where people can own the beach in front of their houses. It goes back to colonial era law.
Okay.
And it's something that comes up many times a year in every town on Cape Cod.
Let's talk about the bike path, very popular bike path on Cape Cod. Tell us where it is and what the concern is about the path now.
Well, it's along the Cape Cod Rail Trail. It's in Eastham, and it's a portion of the rail trail that goes under a tunnel under Route 6. And in the past few years, there's been 17 crashes in and around the tunnel. And local fire and police officials are trying to get the state to make it a safer, like warn people better, put stanchions in. It's a two-lane bike path.
Yep.
And what happens is when you're coming down the bike path, the road dips to go under the tunnel, mm-hmm. takes a turn before you get to the tunnel, and then you get into the tunnel and you're going oftentimes from bright light to dark.
Yeah.
People are hitting the walls of the tunnel. They're crashing into other bicyclists. There's the fire chief, Mark Foley, said there's been 17 crashes since 2010, including multiple patients have had to be taken to Cape Cod Hospital by ambulance. A few had to be flown to Boston hospitals because their injuries were so severe, head injuries. And what they've been trying to do is, like I said, trying to get it more safe. The state has put up signs warning people to slow down and warning about the curve, but that doesn't seem to – people aren't really paying attention to that. They don't think – they'd like to have stanchions that divides the – at least divides the two lanes, so that would prevent people from going into hitting people head on.
Okay. So they're going to be working on that one. There's an interesting story in the paper this week about a Sandwich, the town of Sandwich substitute teacher who has reached a settlement with the town, says he was wrongly fired.
Right. This is Jonathan Hurley, a 32-year-old teacher who moved from L.A. to Cape Cod to become a teacher. He was a long-term substitute in Sandwich, but he was fired. And he says it was because of he also is into music, and he had a music video of a song that he and another fellow wrote, which mocks religious beliefs. And Hurley says that it's a lighthearted describes it as lighthearted, but that's not how it was interpreted by Sandwich school officials. Once he was fired, he was also blackballed from substituting anywhere in the Sandwich School District.
Hmm.
So the ACLU actually took his case under the First Amendment, a violation of his First Amendment rights. And once this suit or action was filed, the town attorney immediately, very quickly acknowledged that they were wrong, and they settled with him for he will not have any. They've removed any reference of his termination from his records, and they'll provide him with positive references. He also receives some monetary or some kind of compensation, but no one is commenting on how much that was.
Which is it's always strange to me when a municipality settles a case and doesn't announce how much the town is paying out, since it's taxpayers' money. So I agree with you on that. For announcing what you've settled things for when you're a town. You're not a private
right.
business. Let's move on quickly to just a short story in one of the papers this week. Four Falmouth police officers suspended with pay, but not a lot of details on that. Has anything come out? I think that story was 2 days ago.
No, we haven't heard anything that I know of. Police Chief Edward Dunn wouldn't name the officers involved, but there were four police officers, including a sergeant. They've been placed on administrative leave for an incident. We don't know what it was. That happened around July 4th weekend. And so we don't know the details. We don't know what the objection was.
Well, you'd think it would be something fairly significant if four officers
right.
are suspended. Well, the good thing is, with pay, of course, typically police departments will do an investigation, and then if journalists FOIA the Freedom of Information Act request for those results, they're usually pretty good at giving them up. So I expect we will hear what happened.
We probably will, but just to say, different departments take different lengths of time.
Yeah,
if you ever want something from the state police, you better get your child to go into the business, so they might be able to get the results of that request.
Okay.
But I'm standing on my soapbox here, I know. But
no, well, that's experience. You filed some of those as you were a reporter for many years. National Seashore has banned drone use on the beaches. I think that's pretty much all we need to know there.
Right. It's
right? I don't know who's bringing drones to the beach. But...
Right. Well, there are people actually bringing drones, and they're taking pictures and other things.
Okay.
If you go online, what they're saying, and that the National Park Service announced June 20th that they're going to evaluate whether unmanned aircraft should be allowed, but until they make that evaluation, they're not going to allow people to use the drones, and that's what George Price, superintendent of the seashore, has done. And they will still allow electric-powered model airplanes, as long as it's not in areas that have signs closed bird use area, that signs around they can't use the airplanes there. But we got a lot of comments on our Facebook page about this story. Just they're wondering what the objection is, and so.
Oh, okay. Let's move on a little bit. Let's talk about Sandwich once again, the Sandwich Recreation Department. Briefly on this one, I guess there's been some questions about the finances of Sandwich Youth Soccer, and so the town is getting involved with that.
Right. There's an investigation going on about the treasurer, Kimberly Hansen, who was the Sandwich Youth Soccer Program was a private entity. And since this investigation started back in May, looking into how money was being spent, there are people who have been hesitant to sign up with the Youth Soccer League. Also, the Youth Soccer League is having a hard time financially running the program. So the Town Recreation Department has taken it over and will now be running the program. There's about 1,000 kids participate in the program traditionally. So far this year, about 400 children have signed up. And I think because that's one of the reasons the town took it over, they're not seeing as many kids joining up. Mm. Probably because their parents might be worried about the funding.
And, of course, that's still under investigation.
Right. No charges.
No charges filed against this Sandwich Youth Soccer official. There was a short story on the front page of today's sports section about Meb Kevlezi. And I know I'm saying that last name wrong, but that's okay because everyone knows this guy as Meb. Meb won the Boston Marathon in April, and the big news is he's coming to run the Falmouth Road Race on August 17th, a really significant road race, one of the most respected road races in the country.
Right, and when Meb won last April, he was the first American man to win the marathon since 1983. Now he's going to he runs the Falmouth Road Race every year. He has come in as a runner-up, but was always the first American to cross the finish
mm-hmm,
line,
mm-hmm.
And now he hopes to bring his magic to Falmouth this year.
And it sounds like he's going to be participating in events. He had a lot of nice things to say about
right.
Cape Cod and the Falmouth course. He says it's one of the most beautiful courses in the country. And there's a lot of events around that August 17th Sunday race, including a fun run with the kids on Friday. He's going to be part of that and part of the expo the day before. So there'll be a lot of Meb, and he is really
right.
the hottest name in distance running right now. I'm sure Dan Tridel will give him a run for his money at the road race.
Well, I just want to say, too, he also says he feels like as if he had grown up here because people are so good. You know, he feels very welcome here, and he likes the Cape.
I'm not surprised. Briefly, we've only got a few seconds left here, but it's going to be a big weekend in Bourne. Lots going on with the celebration of the Cape Cod Canal with its tall ships in the area. Can you give us a quick rundown on what's happening? So much.
There's tall ships at the Mass Maritime Academy. They have the Coast Guard boat Eagle will be there this weekend. And then the beginning of next week is the Kaimar Nickel, another sailing vessel. There's going to be a lot of fireworks over the canal on Tuesday.
Wow.
By the way, people can come down and tour the tall ships. There's many other events going
well,
on.
Well, folks should go to the
right.
Cape Cod Times.
CapeCodOnline.com/canal100 for
all right, great.
Calendar of events.
Thank you, Ann Brennan, Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online, joining me here in our Woods Hole studio. We appreciate it very much, Ann.
Thank you.
And, of course, you can follow Ann on Twitter, at Ann Brennan, CCT. Thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim Deruda of the New Bedford Standard Times, Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner. I'm Sean Corcoran. Thanks for joining us.